Welcome to an iTech 15 speaker presentation. This file has been brought to you by Christian Education National. Enjoy and connect to www.cen.edu.au for more information.
My name is Lindsay Gregg and I hail from Geraldton in Western Australia, which is a long way from anywhere, of course. And I've been teaching there for about 14 years. It's my privilege to be able to share with you this afternoon. And this is basically my doctoral thesis. And so right at the end there'll be a link, and if you want to go and check it out in full, you're more than welcome to. So this is the title of it. It's entitled Some Implications of New Creation Theology for Christian School Curriculum. It's really just a few little insights into a larger document. And what I'd like to do is... let's pray for this. Heavenly Father, I thank you for this wonderful opportunity to share to an amazing group of people who have gathered here for this whole conference. And I thank you for all the people who have put so much time and effort into getting here and to delivering and blessing us and enriching our lives. And I just pray that here and now, in this small way, this also might occur in the lives of these people. We thank you for all the people here. We just ask that you would bless us and enrich us and send us into your world to be your new creation. We thank you for this in your wonderful name. Amen. What I'd like to do is to talk about three things. The first of all is curriculum, but I'm going to be a bit deceptive because I'm actually going to talk about the idea of curriculum and not specifically the Australian curriculum, but it will be nonetheless valuable. Secondly, I'd like to talk about this idea of new creation theology and where it's derived from and its implications. And finally, I'd like to talk about some implications that derive from it. I guess what I'd like to do is to start by getting you to think about what is the problem in this picture. What is the issue with which we have to deal with, or if you like, God has to deal with? What is the problem in the picture? You might want to hold the answer to the question in your brain. You probably already made the decision. So let's think about curriculum. Most people, when they think of the idea of curriculum, is when you go back to university and you do curriculum development and you spend a long time thinking about the planned learning activities that you were going to present to your students. And if you've ever heard of Murray Print, it's quite a well-known book. If you've done Curriculum Planning 101, you would have encountered that text or something like it. So in other words, curriculum also is the process of providing continuous personal meaning to individuals. That's what, if you like, curriculum does. The concept of curriculum has a particular purpose. He presents in this particular book all the different sorts of models. There are some that are static, some that are dynamic, some that are circular, some that are linear. And he just says, well, curriculum is a process. And, as a teacher, you can become very good at this particular process. And it's where teachers spend most of their time.
Excuse me, can I please just interrupt? There could be people in here who haven't actually booked the talk. And if that's the case, we've got people out here that have booked. And there's no seats. So I was just wondering. Sorry.
Can we accommodate them anyway?
Sorry to be brutal. I don't think there's any
space. Okay.
I'll
stand in the back.
Probably stand there. Yeah. Wait,
listen.
Sorry
to interrupt. Oh, that's okay. Not a problem. Please grab a chair.
There's two seats, ladies.
And that's what teachers become very good at doing. They become experts at this process. And I'm sure as teachers you would say, yep, I can do this. So in terms of curriculum, what does curriculum mean? Well, I suppose if we were to unpack the idea, we might say that curriculum is a meaning-making activity that delivers a framework for understanding the world. Curriculum also is a particular set of worldview practices that are repeatedly reinforced. So we're going through and we're not only establishing a worldview framework, but we're reinforcing that particular framework. We're also, in curriculum, transmitting a set of ideas about identity, because that's the first and fundamental question about that worldview does. Who am I? Or who are we? Is the first worldview question that's addressed. And so the case of my thesis, if you like, was that in curriculum is established identity. And so therefore what we actually had to do was to say, okay, the critical aspect of curriculum is to understand what we are reinforcing about identity. My doctoral supervisor was a guy called Brian Hill. He's now in his late 70s and retired. And he wrote a really good book, and my practice is to throw up, often people like at conferences will throw up a quote, and I love them. I've ordered 4 books already so far, this in 2 days, over $100 worth from Book Depository. And I really enjoy coming to conferences and getting titles of books. That book is, I think, out of print, but it's well worth getting hold of. And it was his master's degree. Brian Hill was my supervisor. And he looked at 10 individuals. And he looked at the idea of, you remember C.S. Lewis's book, Men Without Chests? What was the actual title of the book?
Abolition of Men.
That's it, Abolition of Men. Well done. And he talked about the idea of men without chests. Brian Hill talked about education and endangering the individual. And he focused in on 10 individuals, and Dewey in particular, but he said what Dewey promoted through learning by doing was education in and for secular scientific democracy. So for Dewey, that was his specific aim, and it's been a very powerfully influential concept in curriculum in our day. There's another guy who picked up on this, and it's actually scientific curriculum. They then claim, well, that's about preparing us to become adult. And in terms of curriculum concepts, there's no more crucial notion in the entire theory. All right? To go even further, we get this guy called Pinar, and you've probably heard of some of these people. He says the curriculum is the site on which the generations struggle to define themselves in the world. So you can actually see how critically important curriculum becomes for us as educators. And so what we do is, if we implement the curriculum, we are implementing identity. In actual fact, we're shaping the human. And we know this. This is something that's just a part of what we do, our bread and butter. In my thesis, I go back a little bit and talk about the history of certain ideas. And this man is quite influential. He would have considered himself a Christian. And he asked the question, you know, do I exist apart from myself as my body? In other words, am I a thinking thing? And he went on to say, yeah, I am. I exist. This is certain. But for how long? And would he cease to exist if he stops to think? Am I a thinking thing? And then he arrived at his thought, I think, therefore I am. And you often hear that phrase. Well, that was actually a religious affirmation. It was a statement of his faith. But in actual fact, it's become a statement that's used to drive a wedge between faith and reason. And he was actually trying, as a person, to articulate his faith apart from the real world, as it were, what he considered to be the real world. It's an interesting thought. What has happened in education is that people like Nell Noddings, who's a theorist herself, she said that the Western schooling model could be understood as having developed from an increasing set of metaphysical dualist ideals about the person and their place in the world. So that dualism has become the reigning, if you like, idea in our culture that's set to establish identity in the material, in the physical realm as opposed to the immaterial world. And this has been challenged in our culture. The Enlightenment would claim for us that the project is successful and it's been completed. And it's now manifested and now it's working well. And what you see is as good as it's going to get. There are people like Patrick Slattery, who you might have heard of, is another curriculum theorist in the States. And my secondary supervisor, that was her doctoral supervisor, and so we were really well matched in a way. He said, however, about the Enlightenment, that it created a new educational paradigm which understood curriculum as a technological text. This paradigm was as much a proposal to advance society into enlightened thinking as it was a reaction against the authoritarian theology of the Middle Ages. science replaced religion as the voice of authority on the mysteries of the universe. However, he says, that the commitment of modernity to Cartesian dualism, which is what they now call what Descartes developed, is a postmodern vision will thrive only once there is a clear understanding of the negative impact of the modern milieu on the human spirit that has been rent asunder. So this idea that what we have in contemporary curriculum is a division of the person, a division of the person into the realms of the material, the immaterial, the rational, the irrational, the spiritual, and the material or the concrete. And that is what most people think has been fixed and is final. And that is what there's attempted to deliver in the curriculum, is what we would presume. So curriculum endorses a worldview orientation imbued with a set of values and attitudes that potentially reinforce an understanding of the person. That's where we're going. Curriculum might also represent an ideological vehicle for a privileged reflection of a particular cultural context. And if this sounds a bit dry, this is what I had to do with my thesis, so I'm sorry I'm not Rocky. Did you go to Mark Rocks? He's brilliant. If you've not seen Rocky, go tomorrow if you get a chance to see Mark Rocks. He's really entertaining. The person facilitated by a particular curriculum context might then be predisposed to adopt that particular worldview and act accordingly. Okay, so curriculum then becomes very powerful. So if the curriculum is about establishing the establishment of identity, then Christian educators obviously need to be aware of what they're endorsing. So in my thesis, I actually said, okay, where do we go to understand what's being endorsed about a particular person in the curriculum? And I didn't actually go to the curriculum, I went to this document. It's rather ironic, as Rocky would say, it is ironic that I'm in Melbourne now and I use this in a particular chapter to understand or try and unpack the sort of identity that is being established in Australian education. Are you familiar with the Melbourne Declaration? It's been out for a while now. What it does was it claimed that it would set the direction for Australian schooling for the next 10 years. And in setting the direction, I would suggest to you that it sets a path and develops an identity for a particular person. Okay, so it's establishing a particular person. It is, if you like, the heart of the curriculum, the beating heart. I was going to use the analogy of an engine, but since I had cars, I choose something a bit more organic. And what it does is it claims to place at the very centre of the curriculum a young Australian. So it is about identity, and it has a particular set of ideas that it wants to establish in the person. It says that these educational ideas will position young people to live fulfilling, productive, and responsible lives. So if we think of it in terms of a template, we're thinking in terms of particular characteristics that the Australian curriculum wants to establish in the person. Now, of course, these are overlapping, they're very complex, they're not obviously definitive, because they would say, oh, this is just a limited list in a short document. But if you think about it, what it's doing is facilitating one person, and by omission, diminishing another. And that was part of the argument. It also goes on to say that as a nation, the role of education is building democratic and equitable and a just society that is prosperous, cohesive and culturally diverse, and of course that values indigenous cultures as part of the past, the present and the future. So in terms of the person, you know, they've added to this fulfilled, productive and responsible, democratic, equitable, a person who's just, someone who's has this cohesive sense of themselves, is prosperous, and so on and so forth, and culturally diverse. The idea that this then represents a template for establishing a particular individual. And then it goes on and says, well, we'll finish this off by saying, well, we want some values. There's going to be values, we'll repeat democracy, equity, and justice, but we'll have personal values. Personal values of honesty, resilience, and respect for others. And of course, this is not what you would say a complete person from our perspective, but for the Australian curriculum, these are values that they're offering up for a person. Okay? So this is the sort of identity that's being established. I proposed, but then, okay, let's think about that in terms of the context in which we find ourselves. The ideal is that they wanted to present a particular person, but they said, okay, there are new demands that are placing pressure on this person. And these demands, however, even though we recognise they're problematic in some ways, they've increased rapidly, they're new and exciting, they present real opportunities, and they're emerging. And those sort of cliched responses you may have heard before elsewhere. So some of these include global integration and mobility, the idea of Asian literacy, technological change, environmental scientific progress, and information and communication technology. Now, we have heard how these represent things that will bring to the Australian curriculum opportunities and excitement. But in each of these cases, I was able to sort of say, and I remember my doctoral supervisor saying, don't you have anything good to say about the Australian curriculum? Because I was focusing in on those and saying, oh yes, but, and hammering each of these, because I felt that these were in themselves categories which were false. There are great benefits in all of these things, and scientism is the issue, as you probably heard, not science itself. Information and communication technologies are wonderful, but it's the, if you like, the idol, the way they've been turned into idols, that becomes the issue. And so all of these things are dealt with and permeate the curriculum, if you like, and then become the things that define us in this particular age. In other words, they are the context which shape the person. And so I've used those in conjunction with the image just to give you an idea that, okay, if this is the template that they want to produce these sorts of characteristics and these are the demands that are placing pressure on that template, can we get that person from those demands, if you like, or from that context? And so what we end up with is the idea of the person is produced, the adequate person is produced by the material context. So when you think about the implications of that, there is nothing else but the now and the material from which we produce the person. Which means, in a way, that we are shutting out a whole other sense of the person in the spiritual. And of course, I can see the people like, yes, okay, we're missing something here, there's something that's missing. So in other words, in the Australian curriculum, are we getting an adequate person? And that was the question that I was asking myself. Are we getting an adequate person? So that's what we hold in our minds. Specy. I attempted to factor into this idea other issues. I'm not sure whether you've heard of this book. It's by a guy called James Howard Cussler. He describes himself as a non-practicing Jew. And he's a bit like Jeremiah. He rants and he raves and he carries on. And he maintains that we are heading towards disaster. He doesn't have a faith in God, but he recognizes this problem. And he starts, as some people might have heard, from a place called Hubbard's Curve. Have you ever heard of Hubbard's Curve? He was a geologist, and he predicted that there would be a tipping point in terms of crude oil production on the surface of the Earth. Now, you might think, what's this got to do with curriculum? Well, he suggested that there was a finite amount of a particular resource that we use, and we have actually passed the point where we have used up, in the last 100 years, half the known oil reserves on the surface of the Earth. And in the next 30 years, we will use the remaining half. Okay? Now, that has really serious implications for the future in terms of the vision of the Australian curriculum and the material person. If we factor this back into the equation, let alone factoring back in the idea of a biblical worldview, which we'll do in a moment. And so you have people who sort of say, okay, we're at a particular point where we're going to hit what's called Seneca's cliff. Okay, so if the whole of our modern culture is built on this idea of energy based on black gold, and we've come to think of ourselves as being modern based upon this black stuff, what happens when it disappears? And he sort of points out the fact that to replace, if you like, all of these resources to facilitate this incredible life that we have and this person that we're establishing, we're actually going to need all of these things, and we have to do this for the next 50 years. In other words, for every cubic mile of oil we use, we actually have to have 32,850 wind turbines, and we have to build that many for the next 50 years because we burn 86 million barrels of oil a day to keep the lights on. And what he says is that the whole ideology of what we call being modern has been constructed on this idea of the oil age. So every characteristic about the condition we call modern life has been as a direct result of our access to abundant supplies of cheap fossil fuels. Now, the connection between that and the person of the Australian curriculum is that these ideas are drawn from the material. And so we have this glowing view of the future that's presented to us in the Australian curriculum, and which we facilitate, which is about a future which may cease to exist in the next 30 years. So the assumptions that form the basis of the Australian curriculum frame the material context as sufficient for the development of a flourishing person. That's what I would put to you. Secondly, there is an assumption that human nature is altruistic, responsive, and will collectively adopt and have the capacity to enact such a representation of the self. So the person of the Australian curriculum says, we can do this. We're able to do this. And finally, the Melbourne Declaration then demonstrates considerable faith in humanity and their ability to solve the problems of the world through the curriculum process grounded in a scientific worldview. Okay, so you might say, okay, so what? And as doctoral supervisor, we'll always say that, okay, so what? Okay, so what?
Can dolphin oil be used as an alternative source of energy? After months of research and thousands of dead dolphins, scientists have an answer. No. And now for our top story from New York, where one man is about to make world history.
The recording system is ready. Are you nervous?
Nervous?
The world was shocked Monday when it was announced that at noon today, God will communicate with Ike Simmons, a 31-year-old insurance clerk from Queens.
Lord, I've been talking to you since I was a little kid. I feel so honored that you would talk back.
Ike, I am the Lord your God who created the universe. I don't need you to jerk me off.
Oh, wow.
Such a typical human.
My client, God, has stated that he will not answer questions about the following topics: death, the meaning of life, good versus evil, creation, prayer, the Bible, anything to do with religion. What can he ask about? Cooking.
When making the chicken glaze, is it better to use port wine or dry sherry?
Good question, Ike. Port wine is only stopped halfway, so it'll make for a sweeter glaze. Sherry, like Fina or other port wine.
Last summer, my wife was pregnant and lost our baby. Was that a necessary part of your cosmic plan?
That's not a question about food.
Why do some cookies turn out perfectly golden brown and others get burnt to blackened coals because no matter what they do, they can never be happy?
Have you tried greasing the pan?
God, why did you make life so shitty?
I can tell you, but it makes no difference. You will be dead in 20 minutes anyway.
What?
The press has been unable to find any noteworthy achievements in Ike's history, only his high school yearbook superlative, least likely to do anything important.
No, I've been good.
Do I look like Santa Claus?
I have a wife.
She'll be dead too. Everyone will be. Your universe ends today.
This is the end of the world? That's what this is about?
I want to make way for another project.
But billions of people are just gonna...
You said yourself, their lives are shitty. I'm going to make a better world with a new set of people. Men will have two penises.
Okay, let me ask you one thing. Why me? Why are you telling me this?
You are such a typical human.
Stop saying that!
But that is the answer. I chose you because you are completely typical in every way. Average intelligence, average attractiveness. You are the most average person on Earth. It was a tough choice between you and an Indian man named Ajay Kothari. You are the prototypical human, so who better to represent mankind? Ike, the real reason I called you here is so that you can relay a message to the world. Tell them that despite the bloody horrors and earth-shattering explosions you're all about to experience.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Some have speculated God will use the interview to promote his upcoming book, The Newest Testament. Warner Brothers is already negotiating a movie adaptation starring Ryan Gosling as God.
Forget my apology, Ike. You know what always cheers me up? Destroying the universe. You have 30 seconds. 30, 29, 28, 27, 26, 25, 24, 23, 22,
wait.
21.
Dolphin oil!
20.
I get it!
19,
people are terrible, and
18,
we kill each other, and
17,
and we murder dolphins
16,
for energy? That's
15,
exactly why
14,
you don't need to end the world.
13.
Because we
12,
can do it for you.
11.
Why 10, get your hands dirty when we can do what we
9,
do best? It won't
8,
take long. Al Gore says so.
7.
If we keep living the same way, we can destroy the world within
5,
the next few lifetimes, and you won't even have to lift a finger.
3, 2. I want to start my new project soon. Do you promise to demolish your Earth quickly?
I swear to God.
Breaking news! Ike Simmons has just emerged. He's about to make a statement.
Keep up the good work.
Heal. the whole world in his hands. He's got the...
I'm sorry about the swearing there, but it actually makes a very good point about curriculum, is that we don't have to do anything, and we've got... The point is to keep up the good work. If we participate in the curriculum process as it's delivered to us, then maybe we're contributing to the demise of the earth and the destruction of what we call a human being. It's a very pointed film. Has anybody seen that before? It's quite powerful, isn't it? It's quite hard hitting. I actually showed my Year 12s that a couple of weeks ago, with permission, of course, from my principal. And yeah, they were quite impressed. In fact, one of the parents of one of my students said, "Have you seen this?" And so I thanked him very much. So really, that's, in a way, in my thesis, I actually came through the Australian curriculum with its idea about curriculum being about the establishment of a person. And I wanted to say that this person was flawed. This person was going to be a problem. And I then actually had to say, well, how are you going to tell us that? And how do you know that the person, the curriculum, is a problem? And then, of course, I said, okay, I'm going to do it through this idea of new creation. I commute to school, and I have done so for a decade or more, and I've estimated that I've ridden around Australia, which is really good. I would like to do that one day, but I'm not sure whether I have enough time or energy left. It would be a great thing to do. But along the way, when I first went to Strathalbyn, about 14 years ago, in the very first week, the principal, in all his infinite wisdom, and I was just so grateful, had a week's PD with a guy called Mike Gaheen. And he actually came from Canada to Geraldton, of all places, and he delivered this PD, and he gave me an article which was called How Can the Bible Be Authoritative by N.T. Wright. Never heard of this guy before in my life. Well, I was ready for not only Christian education, having taught 18 years in you know, like a non-Christian environment, in a secular system, as you might call it, and had been, at the end of that 18 years, been quite frustrated, and was given an opportunity to go into Christian education, which was absolutely wonderful. It was about like dying and going to heaven, or the equivalent of it. And I had this article, and I read this article, and it was just the right person at the right time. And since then, I have basically devoured almost everything this guy's written. And I used to listen every day as I would ride on my bike to school, his lectures. And we'll talk about him a little bit more. But it was through his writing and this concept, this idea of new creation, that he has really, I guess, amplified and clarified for this generation, that I then came to see what the problem was with the concept of the person in the curriculum. So there's this idea of new creation. Now, it's not idiosyncratic. In other words, it's not just him who talks about it. But there are lots of people. William Dalrymple is an Australian guy, and in the preface of this book, which you might want to think about, I'll throw all these texts up. Some of them may be of value to you, some may not be. They're all listed in my thesis, which is online, and you can go to the reference section. But a lot of people claim that the scriptures are about, in broad terms, creation to new creation by way of redemption. It's the renewing of the whole creation. That's the ultimate story. And one of my favourite versions of the Bible, the pictures from my childhood, in Isaiah, it says, "I am about to create new heavens and a new earth. The former things shall not be remembered or come to mind. Be glad and rejoice forever in what I am creating." And that's God speaking. People such as Moya Hubbard have said that the biblical story from beginning to end can be rightly described as an epic of new creation, this concept of new creation. Tom Wright himself, when he writes these, you know, these in a less formal way, if a translation of the New Testament can be considered to be a less formal way, if anyone is in Christ, there is a new creation. Everything old has passed away. See, everything has become new. And then in Galatians, it says, at the end, a new creation is everything. Tom Wright translates that as saying, in his particular New Testament translation, what matters is new creation. And so if you've read Galatians and you read it as a kind of like a reformational grace and law argument, he says, well, it's about new creation. And he said, what matters in the final analysis is new creation. You've probably heard of Graham Goldsworthy, and if you've studied with NIC, you'll know that this text is for ED500. Even Graham Goldsworthy says, the consummation of Christ's work is the new heavens and the new earth, is the dwelling place of God with his people. And again, if we go right to the end of the scriptures, it caps it off. And, you know, see, the home of God is among mortals. He will dwell with them and they will be his peoples, and God himself will be with them. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more, for the first things have passed away. And the one who is seated on the throne said, see, I am making all things new. It's just such a wonderful promise. And it became a focus point for me. Now, often we have a kind of like people in our lives who kind of resonate, and you encounter someone who writes in a particular way and talks in a particular way, and it just kind of, all the things fall into place. And probably for some people, you might not know of C.S. Lewis, and C.S. Lewis, for his generation, N.T. Wright has been likened in this generation to the same voice. In fact, some of you might know Surprised by Joy. N.T. Wright is kind of like amplified and been called the C.S. Lewis of his generation. In fact, some of his texts, such as Surprised by Hope and Surprised by Scripture, echo this association. Surprised by Hope is on sale down in the bookstore, and if you're interested, very much worthwhile reading as an introduction to some of the ideas. It's subtitled Rethinking Heaven, the Resurrection, and the Mission of the Church. He's also done another one in the Surprise by... No, that's not the Surprise by... Also another kind of like a thread, this Mere Christianity. N.T. Wright's done a group of texts using the word simple as opposed to mere, so simply Christian, simply Jesus, and simply Good News, the latest one of all. And all well worth reading if you're not plugged into him at all. The idea of new creation comes through. He's also been likened to the Karl Barth of his generation. Karl Barth, as you probably know, spoke into the totalitarian regime, the Nazi regime of Hitler and of that Europe and Second World War at that particular time. I love that kind of phrase, you know, the answer is Jesus. Well, what's the question, guys? Apparently there's a story of him walking once into a group of theological students and saying, Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. That was his theological mantra, if you like. And his church, his dogmatics, you know, go to volumes. N.T. writes a bit the same. His more academic writing exists in about, you know, projected 6 volumes of work. They're all about 300, 400, 500, 600 pages long. And if you've got nothing to do for the rest of your life, you might be interested in volume 1, volume 2, volume 3. And each of them elaborates in a particular way this idea of the fact that God is about to do and has always planned to do something new. He is about to bring his new creation. And they're just huge. Theologically, if you're interested in immersing yourself in what he's actually got to say and really refreshing for this generation, I think that's the key, is that he refreshes for our generation the biblical narrative in terms of new creation, then they're well worth reading. One which is, as I said, downstairs, Surprised by Hope, he says things like, the whole of new creation is precisely the world of new creation. As such, it is open to and indeed eager for the work of human beings, not to manipulate it with magic tricks, nor to be subservient to it as though the world of creation were itself divine, but to be its stewards. And stewards need to pay close, minute attention to that which they are stewards, in order to better serve it and to enable it to attain its intended fruitfulness. He goes on to say that what our job is to reflect God, both to reflect God back to God in worship and to reflect God into the rest of creation in stewardship. That's what we're called to do. He also says that the risen Jesus is both the model and the model for the Christian's future body and the means by which it comes about. So the power of the resurrection is integral and essential to the idea of new creation. He also says human beings, given their heartfelt allegiance to worship that which is not God, one of the primary laws of human life is that you become like what you worship. What's more, you reflect what you worship not only back to the object itself, but to the outward, but also outward to the world around. And he said, what you do with your body in the present matters because God has a great future in store for it. And these ideas challenge some of the ideas about the Enlightenment departure that we might be hooked into in terms of some of our theologies. Another one of his books, which is very important, and I really enjoy and would encourage you to get a hold of, and I use a bit, is After You Believe. He says, the Christian life in the present with its responsibilities and particular callings is to be understood and shaped in relation to its final goal for which we've been made and redeemed. The better we understand the goal, the better we shall understand the path toward it. And he also says we need to be encouraged and excited by the pursuit of virtue in its specifically Christian form, and to have their character shaped together and individually to become the human beings God meant us to be, which means being primarily concerned with worship and mission and with the formation of our own character as a vital means to that double end. New creation theology became the lens through which I was able to critique the Australian curriculum concept of the individual. And so what the New Testament does, Wright claims, is it invites readers to learn how to be human in a particular way. You might not have understood the New Testament in that light before, but it adds to the idea that the New Testament calls us to be a human being in a particular way. And the challenge is that we have the Australian curriculum which shapes our students to be particular humans and to orientate themselves in a particular way in the world. He also said, therefore, to be ethical is to be an aspect of our God-reflecting vocation, and suggests this is summed up in the fundamental character of the person who is anticipating the present by patient and careful moral discipline, the goal of genuine humanity which is set before us. What he's calling for us to do is to be fully human. And to be fully human is to be the resurrection people. Another great text, and I'm sorry to throw all books at you. Often you go to a conference and people make a quote and they don't show you the book. I'm showing you the book. This is if you have a bucket list of books, apparently this is one of the top 100 books. You may have never even heard of it. But The Moral Vision of the New Testament by Richard Hayes, and he's a friend of N.T. Wright's, and he lives in America, and they often often challenge one another, sharpen one another up. He said, Paul insists that the fundamental logic of Christian proclamation demands belief in the resurrection of the dead. Therefore, Christian hope necessarily affirms rather than rejects the body. Okay? Particularly important point. To proclaim the resurrection of Christ is to declare God's triumph over death and therefore the meaningfulness of embodied life. That is why, according to Paul, our future hope must be for a transformed body in the resurrection and not escape from the embodied state. And so this challenges some of the thinking. Often kids, if I'm teaching kids the Bible to kids, they'll say, what's the Bible? Oh, they say, basic instructions before leaving Earth. Have you heard that one? I don't know how to challenge that, but that does. But I don't know how to undermine the thinking of some of our, if you like, our children who come into our Christian schools, that really it's all about leaving rather than staying and living an embodied life. And that's the challenge that comes to us from the Christian side of our educational system or our theological traditions in the Western world. So we have these two pressure points. So he says that new creation as an idea, but as a reality, makes possible future hope essential to critique this present order. And so it's a means whereby we can actually have access into saying what's wrong in the now with the curriculum that's being delivered to us and the person it's proposing, and what's wrong with our church traditions that are putting pressure on us to actually believe in a sort of a form of escapism. You know, Jesus Christ doesn't become Lord and Saviour transforming me. He becomes my ticket out of here. Take your ticket, sit down. Just wait a while. He'll be back soon. And then we'll be leaving. So when we talk about worldview, we often talk about these ideas about creation for redemption, and they're very, very good. But often people stall out there, and we often get this idea that somehow Jesus is there floating above reality, and our place is not to remain connected here, but we're actually going to be snatched away. That that somehow this is a temporary state, and it doesn't matter how bad it gets, we're actually going to be relieved of this. And so we have this iconic image of somehow that if we stop at, and redemption, don't get me wrong, not devaluing the fact that I am saved by the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, but that actually needs to be capped off with an idea that completes the process. And it's proposed that new creation is that process, and that's where we're headed, and that our salvation and our redemption is not something that we leave, or that we're designed to have us take us out, but that we are here to be part of the transforming vision of the world. Now, this is an outrageous idea if you try and present it in a scholastic manner. And George Marston said, well, if you try and fit God back into the educational process, if we bring him back into the discussion, the set of questions are going to change dramatically. And so what we're trying to do is, as Christian educators, we're trying to say, okay, the Australian curriculum or the concept of curriculum is about delivering a person, but are we being shut out of that process? Has the curriculum shut us out? So the idea of new creation denotes that there's a created context and a way of understanding humanity planned by God to which the human, by attending to, becomes more fully human. This presumes that if, as claimed, curriculum represents a shaping process of the person, then Christian schooling might have, in terms of new creation, a stronger vision of God's plan and purpose. So it's offered up as an idea that might be helpful to people. So, and again, you've been very patient, lots of talking, very dry, not hard rocks, I love it. I came to three conclusions. The idea of new creation includes the understanding of God's purpose of renewal focuses on the shaping of the person. Okay. The biblical implication is clearly that the development of the fully human will only be realized through the actions of God. And finally, that to be fully human is therefore understood as being formed by a greater God within a larger plan that moves towards the renewal of all things. Once we couch our curriculum goals, our purpose in that, it alters the story. So the end of oil is not going to be an issue for me. I do not mind giving away my iPhone 6 Plus when it's a doorstop, because eventually the energy that drives this modern Western context may alter completely. But if we've invested everything about ourselves and our identity in our cars and our phones and our computers and the 86 million barrels of oil a day that actually drive our modern ideologies, we're going to be sadly disappointed because we'll be caught out on a limb. And that's unfortunately where we are at the moment. And that's the sort of narrative that we're selling to students, and that's the sort of narrative that we're living in. So, if the fully human finds its clearest iteration in the relationship with God, then human identity framed outside a relational construct centered on God results in a diminished understanding of the person, which is what is happening with the Australian curriculum. What's being delivered up is a diminished person. So a theology of new creation suggests human identity is fully established in relationship with God, that it finds that human nature and destiny finds its resolution as the new creation, and new creation sources virtue through the good God. Well, so what? So a theology of new creation would endeavour. What it does is it questions the legitimated discourse regarding human formation through a limited range of economic and social descriptors. Okay, so if we start doing that, that's limited. It's going to push them out of shape. It challenges the formation of the person as human capital, just, you know, getting a job, what I said, kids, a two-story house, three-car garage, a spa, 2.5 kids. We just often, our kids see themselves as just human capital to underwrite progress, for economic progress, and we justify that through science, scientific and technological means. New creation suggests that a person grounded exclusively by thought and practice in a world that creates growth with economic progress as a measure of fulfillment will by omission be seriously deficient. So if we are implementing the curriculum without question as Christian educators, then we are facilitating a diminished person. So what it does is it highlights the reduction of the potential for the person to live more, the more rounded or good life of the new creation. So finally, the implications. And you've been a very patient audience. Are there any questions so far? Okay, thank you. So implications. So the person facilitated by the Melbourne Declaration could be seen as potentially isolated through the schooling process from the understanding of reality apart from the scientific worldview. Now, I haven't really established that, but if you want to go to the thesis and read it through, what it does is it essentially says, okay, we're isolating ourselves if we implement the curriculum without revision or correction or change or addition. So for Christian schooling in Australia, the problem is such marginalisation creates barriers to the framing and implementing of an alternative vision. So if you don't, if you send one dominant message, you're marginalising another. And the claim is that the cumulative pressure of an authorised identity as encapsulated in the Melbourne Declaration creates a particular reified place and time that isolates the Christian vision of the person. Our very buildings, our very timetables and processing, all of the things we do form a construct, a framework in which the person lives. And there are people like, I think of Charlie Justins and Rod Thompson and other people who actually will have studied this and given us information which actually shows that this has an impact on the way in which it's very difficult to squeeze the scriptures back into the curriculum if that is what we're doing, because the very reality of the spaces we've created form a barrier to the implementation of the person or a different sort of person. So we end up isolated. We something worse. So here's Rod Thompson. He said about biblical-based learning in establishing schools that Christian educations are not only proceeding in a fashion diametrically opposed to mainstream Australian culture, they are also behaving in a way that is counter to the Christian subculture, in which, as respondents frequently recognise, the use of the Bible as the basis for belief and action is largely devotional by nature and frequently untrue to the Bible itself. The point is that in the present construct, we have a very bleak future for Christian education if the Australian curriculum and the person that we're producing is enacted. Because unless we enact a different person, we won't be able to fit that into the schema. So we have this sense of collusion. The excluding effect of the possible expression of alternative person to that facilitated by the Melbourne Declaration implies compromise is expected on the part of Christian schooling. So if the unquestioned implementation of the person of the Melbourne Declaration, doesn't roll off the tongue very well, produces compliant, law-abiding citizens, then anecdotal evidence would suggest that this Christian schooling in Australia appears to excel. We do very well at making law-abiding consumers. We do that job well. And we make nice consumers, nice people who go out there and they do a good job. And that might itself be a problem. The Australian curriculum may be no more than a technocratic certainty that squeezes the person into a mechanised understanding of the self that privileges their material contribution to an economic system. Some of you have probably read this particular book by Brian Walsh and Sylvia Kiesmer. They make this sort of statement. They've suggested that what we do in Christian education is collude with the system to such a degree is that we're just squeezing everything out of shape. And why are we playing this game at all? So eventually what might happen then is that I've argued that there is a nullification. It could be said that what has resulted from the progressive disparagement of a reality outside the material world since the Enlightenment is the nullification of any ideas outside a scientific worldview being taken seriously. And the Australian curriculum may in fact do that. So if, as previously argued, new creation theology anchors human virtue and character in the good God, then with the Melbourne Declaration comes the possible nullification of defining the person except through a material context. The possibility of a measure of the person outside of a secular materialist context is therefore diluted through the Melbourne Declaration. These are bold claims, you know, but the point, if you hold it up against the idea of something greater and better in terms of the plan of God in new creation, both for the person and for the world, then there is this idea that it isolates the person, it forces us to collude with the culture, and it eventually will nullify the things we are attempting to do. So we're really beholden to do something about it. The implications are really quite serious, I would suggest. So there is a tendency to isolate the ability to present an alternate rendering of the person. There is a presumption that we're going to conclude, we're going to collude with a dominant and normative discourse, and that potentially there's a nullification of the understanding of the person except through a material reality, a materialistic reality. So if the person facilitated through the curriculum is so powerfully legitimated, and we're actually talking about a legal document that is authorised, and so the Australian curriculum has to be implemented, and your school will be reviewed according to how well you've done that in terms of your programs. And so really there is an expectation that you will be utilising a particular, you will be transmitting a particular identity. That's a worrying thought in itself. So what is the task of Christian schooling? Well, in the light of new creation, I proposed in my thesis that really the purpose of Australian Christian schooling in the light of new creation is to work to establish human identity in a relationship with God. And how you do that is in the person. That you actually have to become that new creation. There's no program that can do it. We actually have to be the people who are living that relationship. That's fundamentally it. Secondly, we actually have to build human nature and destiny as understood from that new creation perspective. It is not the myth of progress or scientific technological development. The Melbourne Declaration suggests that all the solutions to the common man and the world that we've created so far will come through science and technology. But we actually have to say, no, that human nature and destiny is going to be understood from that perspective, and the solution does not come through us. And finally, that we need to practice reflecting human virtue and character as anchored in the good God. I have skipped across the surface, and you've been very, very patient. Thank you very much.
Welcome to an iTech 15 speaker presentation. This file has been brought to you by Christian Education National. Enjoy and connect to www.cen.edu.au for more information.